It is 17-3247 Davis v. Tyson Foods.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm Tom Gilman. I represent Carl Davis, who is the Chapter 13 bankruptcy trustee in Wichita. Mr. Davis is in the courtroom as well. I'm going to do the opening portion of this argument and hopefully reserve 5 minutes for my colleague, Ms. Amix, to do a rebuttal. This case does not involve math, but it is a bankruptcy case. It may be worse. I understand this is the only bankruptcy case you have on the docket this morning. This is a direct appeal from the bankruptcy court in Wichita to this court. It involves the automatic stay, a critical aspect. In fact, I would say one of the top three critical aspects in the bankruptcy code, and the application of the automatic stay. And in February of 2017, this court issued a decision in In Re Cowan. The holding in that case was that at the word act, as used in Section 362A3, is limited to active acts, and that passive acts do not constitute an act that is stayed by the bankruptcy automatic stay. That case sided with only one other circuit court case, the Inslaw case, in the District of Columbia, and was contrary to five other district court cases.
And I think you conceded that it's controlling for us.
It is controlling for this panel.
You think it's wrong, but you agree it's controlling?
I think it's wrong. I agree it's controlling, but I'm hoping that we can convince somebody to vote that this should be heard en banc.
So this is a vehicle for an en banc.
It is indeed, Your Honor. And since you brought that up, I think that this is a perfect case for an en banc hearing. Because
well, good. We haven't had one for a while, and I don't know if we've ever done a bankruptcy. So.
Well, we'd like to be the first.
Yeah.
This, as I read Rule 35 of the Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure, uniformity of the court's decisions and exceptional importance. As I said earlier, Section 362, in my judgment, is, I think, probably the most important aspect in the bankruptcy court. So it's of exceptional importance for those of us who practice in bankruptcy court and try to reorganize businesses, save people's assets and so forth, pay creditors. Uniformity of court's decisions. One of the statements here in Federal Rule 35B, B1B, is questions of exceptional importance if it involves an issue with a panel decision conflicts with the authoritative decisions of other United States courts of appeals. Well, we have four at least, and maybe five.
If we fixed your problem in the Tenth Circuit, there still would be a circuit split out there, wouldn't there?
There is, and it's interesting that you bring that up, too, Your Honor, because there is a case winding its way up on a direct appeal into the Seventh Circuit that involves three cases that were consolidated arising out of parking violations in Chicago and impounding of vehicles in Chicago. Those three cases have been consolidated on a direct appeal for the Seventh Circuit, so this matter is going to be before the Seventh Circuit again, and if there is further split, then it may be headed on up.
Yeah, well, maybe you can make this argument in the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, I've been there once and probably would not like to go back. So,
still your fame.
But anyway, we feel that this is a case that is proper for en banc rehearing, and we think that our best argument in opposition to Cowan is our 362B18 argument. That argument stems from the Parr Meadows decision in the Second Circuit. The Parr Meadows decision is directly contrary to Cowan and was not cited in Cowan. But what happened in Parr Meadows was that there was a bankruptcy filing by the chairman of a company and a similar filing by the Parr Meadows company itself. The only asset it had of any value was a racetrack in New York. The trustees in the bankruptcy sold the racetrack and didn't get enough money from the sale of the racetrack to pay all creditors. And so there was a priority dispute as to who was entitled to the money from the sale of the racetrack. The contending parties were the mortgage holders who had pre-petition mortgages against the racetrack and the county who was administering ad valorem taxes on behalf of the county. The ad valorem taxes, like the lien in this case, the case that Judge Nugent decided, was a lien that arose automatically as a matter of law at a particular time each year, and the county took the position that that lien was not stayed, the attachment of that lien was not stayed by the bankruptcy stay. The mortgage holders took the position that the lien was stayed by the bankruptcy filing, and the bankruptcy court and the district court agreed with the mortgage holders, finding that for the most part, the ad valorem taxes, the assessment of the ad valorem taxes was stayed. That went up to the Second Circuit, and when it was in the Second Circuit, the county argued that the word act should be limited to active acts, and that they weren't stayed because their lien arose under New York law automatically as a matter of law and therefore was not an active act.
Does an act naturally imply some type of affirmative conduct?
Well, that's what the court in Cowan
found. What Judge McKay and that panel concluded.
That's what they concluded by referring to the dictionary definition. I would argue that not necessarily. And I would say that an act can occur by failure to act. For example, if I owned a truck and you had a lien on my truck and you took the truck, repossessed the truck as I defaulted on the loan payment, I filed a bankruptcy, and then I wanted the truck back to get back to work so I could start paying my creditors and take care of my family. And I went to the place where you had my trucks stored. These are basically the facts in Cowan. Mm-hmm. And said, I want my truck back so I can get back to work, and you did nothing. I think that's an act that affects the bankruptcy estate, the ability to reorganize, the ability to pay creditors, the ability to take care of my family.
But you know, in this one, you know, Tyson's really, I mean, it was by operation of law.
As it was.
It seems like it was even more passive than the conduct in Cowan. Would you? Is that true?
It is. No question. It arises by operation of law. The lien that Tyson had in this case came virtually by operation of law. There was nothing they could have done to avoid this lien to attach because it came up as a matter of law, just as the ad valorem tax lien came up as a matter of law in Parr Meadows.
Well, couldn't one argue that the discussion in Parr Meadows as it related to the tax lien being stayed in to the extent that it involved operation of law was dicta? Because, I mean, they in Parr Meadows, they made it very clear that, in fact, there were affirmative acts. I mean, that was the first holding that they had.
It was. They did say that they didn't necessarily agree with them that it was not an active act because they had to go through the assessment process and so forth. But they say even if it wasn't an active act, that they did not agree that it was too narrow of a definition of the word act.
All I'm saying is Parr Meadows, it would be better for you, I think, if the court had rested on a situation where there weren't any acts at all. The court in this situation talked about a number of acts that had taken place, right?
I agree.
Okay.
It would be better if Parr Meadows, if the lien arose by no act at all,
okay,
as it did in this case, as it did in Tyson's case. But the most important part, I think, of the Parr Meadows case, beyond the fact that they found that it was not stayed or that the act was stayed, even though it was a passive act, was what Congress did in response to that decision. They then passed an exception in 362B18 to the automatic stay that was specifically limited to ad valorem taxes on behalf of governmental entities. They could have, had they wanted to address the problem that the Parr Meadows case raised for the various counties across the country, they could have limited the word act by providing a definition in the bankruptcy code. Instead, what they did was they created a very narrow exception, which strongly implies that they thought that passive acts were stayed in the first place. So we believe that argument undercuts the Cowan decision significantly and should be considered. I only have 5 minutes left, and I'd like to reserve the rest of the time for my colleague. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Michael Fielding on behalf of Tyson Prepared Foods, Inc. The appellant here is really essentially making a motion for en banc review, and that's not the issue before this court. The issue is, do you affirm Judge Nugent, who issued the court below? And I think what's critical here...
Are you advocating for an en banc review? Or?
No, absolutely not. I'm actually advocating that you affirm, and I think there's grounds to affirm that would not necessitate an en banc review. One of the big differentiating issues about this situation, there's a number of them. One, we're dealing with a statutory lien, as we well know. There was zero act by Tyson. Judge Nugent found that in his ruling. But number two, a very critical distinction here is this was post-petition payments by Tyson to the debtor. These other cases are dealing with pre-petition debts and issues of actions that are post-petition and whether or not that constitutes an act, which we'll talk about in a minute. But that's a major differentiating part of this aspect. Those benefits became part of the bankruptcy estate by operation of law. Tyson obtained the subrogation lien once that settlement with Aramark was obtained. And by virtue of that, there isn't a circuit split, so to speak, as they're alluding to. And obviously, if there was ever an en banc review, what we would find is that, that wouldn't resolve the situation with the Inslaw court in the D.C. Circuit. Now,
so you're saying that you're not satisfied just to win on Cowan alone? Because they've conceded you win.
Right. Well, and I should back up. First off, I think I made it clear in my briefs, this panel doesn't have the authority to overturn Cowan. They realize that. And so I think on those grounds alone, we have to affirm. In addition to that, I'm advocating that there are these separate grounds as well for which there should be affirmation. I think another key part to address opposing counsel's argument is they rest their argument saying the amendments under 362B18, which dealt with the Par Meadows situation, they suggest that helps their situation. I think it's critical to point out that when those amendments were passed in 1994, and the Inslaw decision, which was issued by the D.C. Circuit Court, was issued in 1991. So Congress makes these amendments with the backdrop of the Inslaw decision, which essentially indicates what Cohen says, which if there's going to be an act, there has to be something done. And Congress doesn't change anything to the bankruptcy code to address the Inslaw decision. I think that's significant. They seem to recognize that, like Cohen recognizes, act means act. You have to do something. There has to be some affirmative action on the part of the creditor here to get the lien. Clearly, they didn't do that, which would I would submit that underscores the fact that the bankruptcy code really is written as it's supposed to be, meaning that there has to be an act that would violate the automatic stay. excuse me, Your Honor. I think what's also important here is the trustees ignoring the reality of the bankruptcy code, which is the automatic stay is designed to protect certain property interests, but the automatic stay does not allow for the avoidance of valid liens, which is what Tyson obtained under applicable law. There's a whole other section in the bankruptcy code, specifically section 545 of the bankruptcy code, which specifically addresses statutory liens and gives the trustee the authority to avoid these statutory liens under specified circumstances. The trustee never sought to avoid the lien here. In other words, he's trying to use the wrong vehicle to avoid a valid statutory lien when there was never anything improper done by Tyson. I think it's also important to point out the equities of this particular case. When Tyson made these workers' compensation payments to the debtor, that Tyson was complying with applicable state law, as it obviously had to do. But because this was in a post-petition world, those payments become part of the bankruptcy estate. And under Kansas law, where you have the right of subrogation, the whole idea is to avoid a windfall to the person who's been injured because they've been compensated for their injury. They then go out and sue the third party, and it's unfair if they sue that third party and then get a double benefit. And that's exactly what the trustee is trying to do with this case. The trustee is trying to take the benefit, the monies that Tyson paid out lawfully, like it should have, to help Ms. Garcia. But now the trustee wants to try to use the automatic stay to void Tyson's lien. So I think in the grand scheme of things here, Your Honors, obviously the panel doesn't have the authority to overturn Cohen. They concede that. The real question is, do we have to go en banc? That's not before the court right now. And I think the fact that we're in a post-petition world dramatically distinguishes this case from the remainder of those cases. And so on those grounds, Your Honor, we would ask that you affirm the lower court.
Right. Counsel, proceed with your argument.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Karin Amix, and I'm staff attorney to Carl B. Davis, the standing Chapter 13 trustee. As Mr. Gelman advised the court, the automatic stay is an exceptionally important part of what we do every day in bankruptcy court. Tyson's deconstruction of 362 carves out an exception to the stay that Congress did not intend. If Congress wanted to create the loophole that Tyson advocates for, I think it would appear in the statutory text and the legislative history. And here, Cowan is the only post-1994 case to hold that act only includes active acts. And to address some of the points made by my opposing counsel, this is about enforcement.
Isn't it significant, though, that their payments were post-petition? I mean, they really get, what's the reason that they should take a reduction or haircut when, you know, they were more or less required to make these payments knowing that there's a petition pending?
The fairness argument is something that a lot of creditors raise in bankruptcy-related situations because a lot of creditors don't think that it's fair that trustees can avoid liens, avoid preferences, challenge liens, argue that liens don't attach. The fairness argument is just something that is often raised. And
don't you think there's a big difference between pre and post petition payments, extensions of credit, likewise?
I don't know what difference that makes here. I mean, we're talking about a Chapter 13 bankruptcy. The automatic stay extends for a longer period of time in a Chapter 13 because it's a longer period for the case to be present, and there are more post-petition assets in a Chapter 13 than as opposed to a Chapter 7, which only involves pre-petition assets. So the fact that it's post-petition, I think, is a problem for Tyson because the whole purpose of having the automatic stay is to stop everything that's going on, protect the property of the debtor's property, the bankruptcy estate, to make sure that it is either liquidated or reorganized fairly and equally among all of the creditors. And oftentimes there are pre-petition creditors who receive payments from debtors, and that money is clawed back and distributed to everybody equally. In this situation, the trustee is arguing that the automatic stay prevented Tyson's lien from attaching to this automatically to the proceeds that were dispersed to Elizabeth Garcia. She is not going to receive a benefit directly from this. There's no double benefit issue here. The money's going to go to her creditors. They would be discharged if the court rules against the trustee. So she's not receiving a double benefit here.
Early in your statement, you were alluding to the fact that creditors sometimes feel it's unfair when trustees try to avoid liens. Well, why didn't you try to avoid the lien? I mean, the point that I understand Tyson to make is there was a vehicle to do what you are trying to do, but it's not the automatic stay provision, and you didn't avail yourself of that vehicle.
Section 545 I don't think would apply to this situation because it wasn't a question of perfection at the commencement of the case. It wasn't a lien for rent or distress of rent, and it wasn't a lien that sprung into existence as a result of the debtor's insolvency. But more than that, the law of the land at the time that this case was initiated was United Federal People's Credit Union versus Yates, and Judge Nugent had ruled in two cases at the bankruptcy court level that the automatic stay would prevent the attachment of a lien in a situation like this, a PIP lien in VZ, and I believe also a PIP lien and maybe an attorney's lien as well in White. So the law of the land at the, when we started this a few
would,
years
would
ago.
Would be that you would win, but that doesn't mean that you there isn't a vehicle that the statute provided for you to use, 545, that was available. I mean, whether you thought, you know, this is not about whether you can win. It's about whether you can avail yourself of a remedy. And if you had a remedy and you didn't avail yourself of it, so the situation of doesn't mean that this should be shoehorned into being a remedy that wouldn't otherwise exist.
Well, I think that in certain situations, 545 would have applied to this, to avoidance of statutory liens. It wouldn't have applied in this situation. We couldn't have availed ourselves of that remedy. That wasn't a remedy here, and we didn't need to because we had another vehicle, the automatic stay's existence, that impacted the ability of Tyson's liens to attach to those proceeds. So for those reasons, we would ask that you give us an en banc rehearing.
Right. Thank you, counsel. Appreciate the rebuttal. Counsel are excused, and the case shall be submitted.